On this week's 51%, we sit down with writer Julie Fingersch to discuss her new memoir, Stay, and debate an age-old question: can women really have it all?
It's hard, but it is possible, and I feel like more and more, if you look around, women are having second and third chapters in ways that they never could have imagined.
We also discuss the importance of mental health care and the cost of keeping mental illness a secret. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Alita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. Our guest today is writer and freelance journalist Julie Fingersch. Fingersch, who lives in California, has written for publications like The New York Times, O Magazine, and The Huffington Post. At one point, she was the former executive director of Boston Cares, the largest volunteer agency in New England. Her new memoir, however, focuses on life closer to home. Stay, a story of family, love, and other traumas, explores a variety of subjects, but namely what Fingersch still calls the mommy wars, that pressure for women to choose between having a career or having a family, and that lingering question that many of us have to answer at some point: can women truly have it all? After the birth of her daughter, Jessie, Fingersch decided the answer to that question was essentially no, and she left Boston Cares to become a stay-at-home mom. In Stay, Fingersch reflects on her changing relationship with Jessie as the latter prepares to leave the nest. And she also finds herself remembering one of her brothers, Danny, who died at the age of 26. Through it all, Fingersch grapples with how to navigate caring for the people you love without losing yourself in the process. Just a heads up that Fingersch's book does touch on subjects like mental health and suicide. It starts, though, with a feeling Fingersch says she never expected to have: jealousy. Jessie is fresh out of high school and just wrapped a summer internship that included work for Hillary Clinton, and she's getting ready to go to college. And Fingersch finds herself feeling jealous of her daughter.
I think my book was really me trying to figure out what was happening. And I think for a lot of women, I think especially at that moment where our kids leave for school, those of us who have kids, and especially those of us who have made the decision to make raising our kids be the central focus, the prospect of our kids leaving, I mean, it's a cliche, but it really is a crisis, because it took us out of kind of mainstream society for, you know, in my case, for a couple decades. And so then what happens, you know, you get to the end and your kids are going off, and there's two parts of it. It's one part is, where did I go? What happened to the me before, like, my life got defined and centered around my family? And then just the external part of, like, oh, the world does not have a place for me. Like, that working world that I used to be very comfortable in, which was my primary focus, you know, for the first whole part of my life, is just no longer hospitable to women who have stayed at home with their kids, because we've been out of the game. We've, you know, whether or not we've lost our skills, it's just, it's a very hard thing. And I mean, I think in the opening scene of the book, where I kind of got my friends around in a circle to ask them, you know, where are you guys in your life? And what do you think you've buried? And what's ahead? You know, there were so many of us who were like, well, I have 2 degrees and I was a lawyer or a doctor, da da da. And now I'm just not qualified for anything. You know, I can get a nanny job. I can't even get a Starbucks job because I'm so out of the computer skills, you know, world. And it's not like we were in a cave. You know, we were all, many of us who stayed home with our kids were super engaged and doing things for the community that are kind of traditionally women's work, but it doesn't necessarily translate, you know, into the rest of the world. And so I think that for a lot of us, and I think part of why a lot of people are resonating with the stories that for a lot of us, I think it kind of took us by surprise, those decisions, the cost of those decisions.
So tell me a little bit more about, I guess, that life before you became a mom and how you made that decision to stay at home. You know, everything that you just mentioned, did you know all of that going in, or was it more of a learning curve for you?
It was a seminal moment in my life where I was, at the time, I was the head of a community organization in Boston and working, I don't know, 60, 70, 80 hours a week. I mean, my husband was a resident in medical school, and often I didn't get home till after he did. And then I got pregnant and I kind of had to decide what I was going to do. And so I'll read you a few paragraphs of what kind of came around that decision. Pregnant with my due date speeding toward me, I was obsessed with one terrifying question. What happens when your identity has been built around one set of things? Academic and professional achievement, let's say, grades and career and productivity. And then all at once, you consider trading that for what society has deemed the polar opposite of things. And I go on to talk about a conversation I had with my older brother, who I often called for counsel. I had no idea at the time that I had unwittingly wandered into the heart of what became known then as the mommy wars debate. This, I would eventually learn firsthand, was a war in which both sides lose. The working moms lose at the hands of a corporate system built for full-time workers. The stay-at-home moms lose at the hands of a society that worships working, productivity, and financial earnings, and in which motherhood is an invisible given. And so on the day when I made that SOS phone call to Red, my brother, a call that would ultimately lead me to decide to leave my job and the working world, I had no idea that I was about to pull the plug on my professional future, in some ways irrevocably. I made the decision to stay home with Jesse, which was, you know, a joyous thing because it was sort of like walking off a field that kind of had no boundaries around it in terms of what you could achieve. And suddenly your life was like this sort of crystal clear journey of like, oh, everything is like very, very clear about what you do. So I wrote, I felt at once liberated and isolated. Before, I was many things. Now I was one thing. I lived in a 7-day a week world of sing-songy, high-pitched tones. Conversations were limited to baby talk. Days of all the same thing, caregiving. A few months into the gig, in a desperate effort to have a conversation that didn't include sleep schedules and mortifyingly named products like my breast friend, I called up one of my former board members to say hello. Jim answered with a warm, familiar voice. We'd worked together for years. Ah, it's Julie Fingersch, he laughed with a breezy edge. Back from the dead? I didn't die, Jim, I said a little too loudly. I'm just home taking care of my daughter for a while. Oh, of course, he said quickly. Most important job in the world.
Ugh.
Can you imagine? I just remember that like seminal point where I was like, oh my God, like there it is.
Yeah, when someone just dismisses you and maybe says what they're thinking without having to actually say it. You know, I think your book really does a really good job at just grappling with the transition to becoming a mom in general. Because, I mean, I'm not there yet, but I'm starting to see some of my friends get married and settle down. And from what I can see, that personal transition when you have children is very hard, you know, because up until then, your life has been about school, about work, about you, really.
And especially when our society isn't really set up for the decision to center on your family. It's just not built for that. It's just sort of like you're either in the world or your mom. And when you're, and if you kind of center yourself around that, it's really hard. I mean, this is a terrible thing to say. And I think this is, I don't know. I think it's kind of a scary thing when people are like, wow, you know, you're so brave to like say the truth. And you're sort of like, okay, is that code for like TMI? But I think it's part of it is because I think I'm saying things that a lot of people who make those decisions feel, which is that has their education been wasted? Like, there was a time where I was like, oh my God, my poor parents, they poured all this money into my education. And, you know, and then for me, that like I was like going towards this dream. And then I just kind of gave it up. And a lot of that, and I mean, I'd love to hear what your generation is thinking about this, but for a lot of us, it was a question of, well, our jobs didn't necessarily, I was working for a nonprofit. I didn't make nearly as much money as my husband was going to be making. So it's like for me to keep working was almost like an indulgence when my salary wasn't going to cover childcare. So it was like, really, am I not going to be my child's primary caretaker just so I can like evolve and individuate and self-actualize?
I don't know. You know, to your point on education, I think my growing view is that it's a privilege and it's worth pursuing just for knowledge's sake if you can make it work anyway. So I wouldn't say that just because you didn't end up working in the field that you studied for that it's all just wasted. But I will admit to having had that fear before, just sort of like, what am I doing all of this for? So I think what you're describing is pretty common. I don't think it's very rare. And I will say that, you know, for some of the women that I went to high school with who have ended up becoming stay-at-home moms, the cost of childcare was definitely a factor. We've talked about how expensive childcare is and how hard it can be to find a couple times on this show. So, yeah, you know, I don't know from personal experience, but it doesn't sound like what you're describing is all that different today, to be honest. You know, just looking back on it, though, do you really think it had to be such a black and white decision for you back then? Do you think it could have, do you think you could have raised Jesse without letting go of your career and your old life?
You know, it's interesting because when I look back, what I wish is that I had not so fully let it go. And I think if I had not so fully let it go, I would not have felt the sense of like a vortex when I got to the end of when my kids were ready to leave. And it was like, what happened? Did I really just let it totally go? And is there any way back? I think the great news for women today, and I think I'm really proof of it, is that there is a way back, but you have to be thoughtful about it. And it also, I mean, this is just one of these things that it's like hard to say out loud, but there is a certain level of privilege that you have to be able to do that. Like for me, I was able to do this because I had the ability to go and sort of get back on my feet as a writer again. It's hard. There's definitely, and our society in America that kind of worships at the altar of productivity does not, it doesn't make it easy for women to get back, but it is possible. And I feel like more and more, if you look around, women are having second and third chapters in ways that they never could have imagined.
We're speaking with Julie Fingersch, author of Stay, A Story of Family, Love, and Other Traumas. A big part of your book is your relationship with your younger brother, Danny, and his struggle with his mental health. You know, by the time the book starts, Danny has been gone for a while. He died at age 26. But you grapple a lot with how your family handled his depression. For those who have loved ones who struggle with depression and maybe thoughts of suicide, what do you want them to know about your experience, but about Danny too?
Yeah. Well, I think probably one of the biggest lessons I've learned in life is that when people we love struggle, especially as women, we have a primal instinct. We want to make it better. We want to save them. We want to rid them of their pain. And that's one really defining theme for me, for my life, and for the life of anyone who has a really close loved one who struggles. The other part is how we present it to the world. And so when Danny, my little brother, started retreating, that was back in the 80s. And we didn't, no one was talking about depression. You know, no one, just wasn't part of the lexicon. And so we just thought it was a phase. And our instinct was, this is private. This is no one's business. And I think we sort of closed ranks around that as a family to just really protect his privacy. And then as things progressed and it was clear that it was not a phase and he was really, really struggling, it seemed more and more important to protect his privacy, because I think in our mind, we thought, well, you know, he's going to get better and we don't want him to have to have that baggage in life to in front of girlfriends, in front of employers, in front of that he, you know, was in treatment or whatever. Because also back then, therapy even was sort of taboo. Like people weren't talking about that. Mm-hmm. So when I look back on that today, and if, you know, if, when I think about the world of today and my own kids and how prevalent mental illness is and panic attacks and anxiety, that it's just, the, you know, the world is kind of melting and shattering in lots of ways. And I think one of the most damaging things is to keep it so close to the vest, because I think there's a cost to keeping that secret. And I think if you are with friends and you see a sign that they're struggling, or, you know, your family member is struggling and they're saying, don't tell anyone. I don't want anyone to know this. If I could have wished for anything back then, I would have wished for someone to say, make sure that's what, you know, he really wants and that what's best for him. Because if you have a friend who, for instance, is, you know, you're out with them and you suddenly are seeing a new side of them that they are used to keeping under wraps, it's probably you haven't seen it because there's a lot of shame in it. And still today, there's so much shame around that, around anxiety and depression and antidepressants. I mean, it's a lot more out in the open, but there still is a lot. And I guess I would just say, like, to really lean in towards it. Don't retreat because they're saying, it's fine, I'm fine. Because likely, if you have a friend who's having a panic attack, it's, or any sort of condition, and whether it's mental or medical, likely they're struggling alone. And that's really the most damaging. Mm-hmm. So I think I look back and I wish we hadn't kept it so private. Now the rest of my family, everybody's different and they still feel they're so supportive of this book, but you know, it's different. Like Danny's gone now, so everybody copes differently with that grief. But I think shame is almost as damaging as the illness, because it's surrounded with silence and isolation. And the best thing we can do is sort of be vulnerable and honest with one another and try to make those, just try to be honest with who you are. Because when you sort of edit life like that, and in today's world of branding and all that stuff, it can be a very damaging thing.
What impact did keeping Danny's situation private have on him, do you think, and on you and on your family over the years?
You know, it's, what's crazy is that I don't even think, I can't speak for my family, mm-hmm. but for me, I think it wasn't until a few years ago when I was kind of, you know, having this hard time with this moment in my life, and I started really writing again. I was asked to kind of share a personal story in my community about something. And it was a decision of, am I going to talk about this? Am I going to talk about this part of my life that, you know, I've lived in Marin County for 25 years, maybe five people knew I even had a brother. And I did. I came out and talked about it, about my brother, and it was so terrifying, Jesse. Like I was shaking. And afterwards, so many people came up to me, many of them privately, to share that they had a similar situation that they were keeping private. And I feel like when people see other people being honest, whether it's Selena Gomez, who's this famous person, mm-hmm. who is public about her mental health struggles, or it's someone like me who's, you know, just a person, it's so helpful for others to start asking those questions of like, what cost is this secret to me? And also to realize that when you hide like that, besides sort of like editing yourself to the world, you're often not doing a favor to the people you're protecting. And I think that that was one of the hardest things for me to reconcile. And I don't know, you know, I speak for myself, but I wonder a lot how helpful that was to Danny, that his, you know, that his life was a secret on some level. I mean, I imagine it isolated him. We thought it was for the best, but looking back, I'm not sure. I mean, it was a different time where, you know, even today, as you know, like people are not, you know, that it's not dinner talk. But I think if he had been able to be more open about what he was going through, it would have been a lot easier for him to have a network outside of his close family and the people who were taking care of him professionally.
The book starts with your daughter, Jessie, heading off to college, but it goes pretty quickly off track. I mean, Jessie ends up needing care as well, and you find yourself in this continued parenting role with her, even though she's an adult. You know, I guess I just wanted to ask, one, how is she doing now? But two, what did you learn from that experience?
Yeah, it's first of all, thank you. She is doing, a few people have said like, oh, you should have written like a thing at the end saying how she's doing, because she is doing really well. And so the story there was that just as we were dropping her off for college, she started having symptoms of a stomach thing, which we thought was gastroenteritis. And it actually ended up being the beginning of a presentation of ulcerative colitis, which is a chronic disease of the bowels. Wow. Which is, it runs a spectrum in terms of severity, but it's very unpredictable. And so she went from being like, what I talk about is like the land of the healthy, where she had always been so, so healthy in every way. She had, like, life had been easy for her, really, to all of a sudden, she was out of school for the first couple of weeks. And she ended up being diagnosed with this chronic medical illness, which has really changed her life. And I think it was like, that's, you know, sort of how the book is, they call it a braided narrative, where it was like going back into that world. But instead of being a young sister trying to help my brother, I was suddenly a mother. And then there's that whole thing about parenting your adult child when they're on the cusp of what should be independence and you're supposed to be letting go. And it just sort of catapulted my husband and I into this new thing we had not, you know, we had rehearsed for like, oh, we're going to drop her off and, you know, she's going to be great and it's going to be hard and she's going to do it and it's fine. But all of a sudden it was like, she's sick. And she's at college alone, 1,500 miles away. Wow. We also had no idea what was going to happen, like how bad it was going to get. And so it was kind of put me back into the role and my husband for the first time as like the boundaries between you and the people you love and what is helpful to them and what isn't helpful to them. And I think that this next part of my life and my relationship with all my Jessie, spelled the same way as yours, is that we both learn so much, she and I. It's learning about self versus other, the difference between codependency and being there for people in a healthy way, you know, and parents, I think, especially for adult children, really walk a tough line because you're both learning how to sort of negotiate between letting go and still supporting them because you're still their parents. So anyway, thank you for asking. She's doing great and learning, you know, her own way of coping with what is a new life for her. You know, that illness has changed her life in really fundamental ways. And I think one thing that's kind of hopeful and amazing is that I think she has learned about balance and choices and priorities. It was, you know, she had an accelerated version of what I was on, of like deciding what matters, because she went from being so incredibly focused and ambitious as I used to be at her age, to suddenly just medically not being able to do the things that she always had been able to do. And then learning from that. And I think that for all of us, it's, that's life, where it's like, circumstances get handed to us and they change and there are no guarantees. And so much of it is about, you know, sort of reframing like what matters.
Well, Julie, thank you so much for joining us today. Lastly, I just wanted to ask about the title. Why did you decide to go with Stay?
So the full name is Stay, A Story of Family, Love, and Other Traumas, which is meant to be a little bit tongue-in-cheek, because the world doesn't want to think of family and love as being traumatic, but any of us who are lucky enough to have either know that it can be both. That title is really, really, to me, it defined the experience of writing this book. But I also, I think it helps to define the experience of reading it for the reader, because it ends up meaning different things to different people. So not to be coy or flip, but it's like, I'm going to not give a pat answer, because there really isn't. It's a word that runs underneath all the themes of the book. And I think it's been really interesting to me, as people have read the book, how differently they've interpreted it according to what their own life experiences are, but also the questions, like the big life questions they're asking themselves in their life about identity and choice and self versus other and relationships. So not to sound grandiose, but I think I want the reader to figure out what that means for them.
Julie Fingersch is the author of Stay, A Story of Family, Love, and Other Traumas. It's out now through Roman and Littlefield Publishers, and you can find it at most major booksellers. You can learn more about Julie's work at juliefingersch.com. Julie, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcast.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. Nightmare down the hall.